This is an ABC podcast.
How do you write a book? This is The Book Show. I'm Claire Nichols. And during my time as host of this show, I've been so lucky to get to ask some of the very best writers in the world to share the secrets to their success. And today, you are going to hear their answers. It's a bit of a different show. I've pulled together some of the top writing tips from the top writers to appear on the program in the hope of giving you a kind of writing masterclass right here on your radio or podcast. So, grab your notepad and let's get started.
If they ask me, I could write a book about the way you walk and whisper and look.
Now, before you start writing, of course, you need an idea. And you can find ideas anywhere, in newspaper articles, in a childhood memory, or maybe even in a food court, like the American writer Tayari Jones.
I wanted to write a novel on some big themes, and so I wrote a grant to go to Harvard University to do some research. And I was at Harvard, I was doing all this research, and I had so much information, but I didn't have a story, you know?
What were you researching?
I was researching incarceration in the States, wrongful incarceration, and I was finding out facts and statistics that would just keep me up at night. But it didn't inspire me. For me, outrage is not inspiring. I'm inspired by ambiguity, and there was no ambiguity in what I was reading. And so I went to visit my mother and talk it over, and I also went to the mall, another thing I do when I'm kind of under stress. And while I was there, I was in the food court, and I overheard a couple arguing. The woman was splendidly dressed, and the man, he looked fine, but I noticed her. She just looked so put together. And I heard her say, clear as a bell, she said, Roy, you know you wouldn't have waited on me for 7 years. And I didn't know him, and I didn't know her. I didn't know any of the details, but I felt confident that he wouldn't have waited on her for 7 years. So in my mind, I was thinking, you're right, girl, you're right. Yeah. But then he said, I don't know what you're talking about, because this wouldn't have happened to you in the first place. And I thought, yeah, you're right, it wouldn't have happened to her. And for me, I feel like I know that I have a novel when both people have a legitimate point.
So you hear two lines of conversation. When do you go, oh, this is a book?
As soon as it's her voice, as soon as she said, Roy, you know you wouldn't have waited on me, and I knew he wouldn't have waited on her, I was intrigued.
Is it unusual to have such a clear burst of inspiration for a novel?
For me, absolutely. I've never had the usually when I write a novel, I'm usually kind of drawing more from my autobiography. And for this book, writing about, you know, a man who's wrongfully incarcerated, that's an entirely different world. And I had never kind of woven a novel just from scratch in that way. And I think that's why I was spinning my wheels so much. And I was looking to the research for the inspiration. I had forgotten the golden rule, which is if you write a novel, you have to write a novel about people and their problems, not about problems and their people.
The very wise Tayari Jones there. And those two sentences she overheard in that food court formed the basis of her novel, An American Marriage. It won the Women's Prize. It's a story that brought together all that research she'd done on wrongful imprisonment, but it only came alive for her after overhearing that mystery couple. So, the first big tip is to keep your ears peeled. You never know when a story idea might present itself. And when you've got that gem of an idea, it's time to make a plan. Or is it? The authors I've spoken to have been pretty divided on whether you should plan ahead or not. Now, If you're very brave, you could try the Lee Child approach. On the 1st of September every year, Lee Child sits down at the computer to start his latest Jack Reacher thriller novel. And usually he has no idea what he's going to write.
In August, I maybe have the idea for the opening line or the opening paragraph or possibly even the opening page, and that would be great. So I do that, and then I think, all right, what would be a good next line or next paragraph or next page? And then it's just like that on and on and on. And it feels very insecure, and it feels like you could run into a problem at any time, and this book could be a failure and so on. But actually, I've really learned to trust it. It works. And what it gives me as an advantage is that I'm not in a straitjacket. You know, I don't have the plan. I don't have an outline. I'm free to wander wherever I want. And sometimes you just spontaneously get great ideas that zigzag off sideways. And I would feel if I had an outline, I really couldn't do that because it would make the rest of the outline meaningless. So I love the freedom it gives me. And it, like I say, it's insecure. The way I describe it is, suppose I was a movie stuntman and I jump off the top of a high building and I'm falling through the air and I'm just hoping that the props guys get the airbag in position in time. That's how it feels.
So if we take your latest book, Past Tense, as an example, on the first page we see Jack Reacher out wandering around. He thinks he's going somewhere. Then he thinks, oh, maybe I'll go to my father's hometown, explore my family's history. At what point in the writing process do you, Lee, figure out what that family history actually is?
Well, about 1 minute before the reader figures it out, because, you know, I'm writing as if I was the reader. And that's a great example, the past tense, because I had the idea for the opening paragraph, and the opening paragraph mentions two things, that Reacher has been in a beach town in Maine for the summer, but now it's getting to be towards autumn, so he's heading south. He's doing his migration like the birds in the sky above him. And that was all I had. That I just thought that was an interesting first paragraph. It was setting up his character, the way that he has no particular place to go. He has all the time in the world to get there. But then I thought, why did I mention these birds? And earlier in the series, many, many books ago, I had mentioned that his father, as well as being a really tough Marine infantry officer, was also a bird watcher. The idea being to kind of humanize him, that he wasn't just this stone killer in the Marines. He was also a human being who loved watching birds. That was years ago I mentioned that. So when I put down about the bird watching imagery in the first paragraph, I thought, oh, this must be a subliminal message about this book should be about his father. And the other part of it was that he had been in Maine, and Stephen King lives in Maine. So I thought, why did I use Maine? And I thought, could I do a separate strand in the book that's a bit like Stephen King, you know, a bit creepy, with a creepy motel maybe in the woods? So I used what I'd subconsciously put in the first paragraph to then power the development of the book. And what happens to all these people, I have no idea at that point. I literally do not know until a minute before the reader knows.
So that's the no airbag approach, courtesy of Lee Child, who actually recently announced that he was retiring from the Jack Reacher series. So good luck to him. Now, Michael Ndaarche is also in the no plan camp. The Sri Lankan-born Canadian-based author is most famous for The English Patient, but he spoke to me about creating his most recent novel, Warlight. And that all started with a simple idea of an English boy whose parents pack up and leave in the years after World War II. And when he started writing, that was pretty much all he knew.
I did not know what was going to happen in the second part of the book when I was writing the first part of the book. So it was almost a very gradual discovery for myself, a kind of archaeology of what really happened.
Did you know where Nathaniel's parents were from the moment you started writing the book?
No, I didn't, actually. I mean, I thought they were going to Singapore. You know, I thought they packed the trunk and that was it. And then, you know, 20 pages later, they discover the trunk has not even left the house. So, I mean, what happens is you're discovering the story as you go along, and then you know, later on you realize that some stuff doesn't really fit, some stuff needs to be, you know, restructured so it'll make more sense as an echo later on.
I can't even imagine what that must feel like, Michael, to be writing. Do you have a moment where you go, oh, that's where they are?
Yeah, well, that does happen. I mean, that there is that discovery. You know, it's almost like you're given a map and you name all the places in the map, and then you realize that, for instance, Nathaniel is going by boat along the Thames and going up canals and so forth, and then you start investigating the canals as research, and then you discover that there's a place called Waltham Abbey, which was a very, very central place for armaments and munitions during not just the present, the Second World War, but many wars in the past. So suddenly there's a kind of recognition that, or realization that there's a link to something that seemed very innocent in the first part of the book.
I'm so glad you mentioned that research, Michael, because the level of research you've done for this book seems so intense. You've learned about espionage, greyhound racing, as you said, the waterways of London, even roof climbing. How long do you spend in a research phase when you're writing a book?
It tends to happen simultaneously. I mean, for instance, when the dogs came into the story, and there are lots of greyhounds in this book, I suddenly had to start finding out about what greyhound life was like in England at that time. I mean, they had to kind of cancel a lot of night races because of the lights was used too much. And then how they started to kind of give them drugs to kind of make them lose races or win races. So stuff like this, which is kind of absolutely fascinating.
Michael Ondaatje there. And let's hear from one more anti-planner.
I don't set out to write a novel about anything.
That's the unmistakable voice of Tim Winton, who talked to me about the creation process for his new book, The Shepherd's Hut.
I think people often have a mistaken idea of what novel writing's like. Certainly from my point of view, I don't do themes or, issues. I write about a place and then the scum that bubbles up out of it, which is the humans. And then I just follow them and see what gives. In terms of this sort of setup to, you know, write about men and masculinity and faith and, you know, what's God and what's not God and how do you exceed your origins, all that all just falls out of the story. There's no intention there for me. And I'm, you know, after the book's finished, I'm puzzling that stuff out myself. It's like, what were you doing there? Or what was all that about?
Now, if the thought of writing without a plan sends shivers down your spine, maybe you'd prefer the Dervla-McTiernan approach. Now, Dervla has written 3 best-selling crime novels from her home in Perth, and she was kind enough to invite me over. And there she showed me how she uses a computer program called Scrivener to diligently plan out each chapter.
What I'm showing you here, Claire, is on the left-hand side of the screen is a list of all my scenes mapped sort of into folder/chapter structure. And on the middle section, you have the writing, the text of the story. On the right, then there's some other things you can use to make notes and use to make the synopsis.
I do really love looking at this scene breakdown. I'm going to read out one that I don't think is a spoiler, but we've got a chapter here called Back at the Station, and the detail is Cormac and Peter talk. Murphy tells Peter that he has a choice. I mean, yeah. that helps you when you go back to the writing process. You go, oh, yes, that's what I'm doing in this chapter.
Exactly. I mean, the key is never to name them with chapter 1, chapter 2. It tells you nothing. What you need to have is, you know, what is the action that's taking place in the scene and what is that going to kick off next? So the logic of the structure of the book is all there in just little one-liner descriptions of each scene. So if that's not there, if you can't read that and see a logical flow, even just with those few words, you've got a problem. And actually, it's a really good way to find out if you have a problem with your book, because if you've written your 80,000 words, you're going back through and you're thinking, oh, there's just not enough movement or logic, then you know you have an issue and you need a bit of rewriting.
I'm just noticing now that these chapters are also color-coded as to who is the narrator.
No,
but I mean, You've got to be a bit of a nerd about this sort of thing, don't you?
Totally. And I mean, these are the truth is, sometimes writing is hard and it's a lot more fun to color code your chapters than it is to work out the knot in your story. So yeah, that's a really good procrastination exercise. I recommend it. But yeah, it has labels. One of the joyful things about Scrivener is that it has labels. So I do color code according to whose story it is. So the blue, for example, is Peter's story, and there's Cormac and Anna. So I can see whose story is getting more focus, and is that nicely paced? I'm very embarrassed now.
That's the very organised Dervla McTiernan. And if you think she's a planner, wait until you hear what the American writer James Ellroy does. His latest novel is This Storm. Just hold on, he actually says it better.
This storm.
You got to say it like that, hey?
Yeah, that's a tiger in me growling.
Thanks, James. So, as I was saying, This Storm is 608 pages long. But before he started his first draft, he wrote a 465-page brief, planning out exactly how the book would go.
I'm very deliberate in everything that I do. The outline for This Storm was 465 pages, so I knew everything that had to transpire in the book, and this allows me to concentrate.
Do you write that brief, and what does it look like?
Well, I don't use a computer, and I write it by hand, and it's very simple. It's Chapter 1, Elmer Jackson's viewpoint. Exposit this backstory. Set the scene. Introduce Ellen Drew. Yeah. Bam. Then he goes to Tommy Glennon's hotel room. He discovers some things. Then I italicize the key information. Once the outline is complete, and I believe that it's structurally, dramatically inviolate, I take it in to my two editors, Sonny Mehta and Edward Gastonmeyer and Alfred A. Knopf, my American publisher, and they read through it. They make comments. Then I go back home and write the book.
And that makes it easier than just writing 100 pages extra the first time, James?
You can't do it that way. If you want a perfect, huge novel where everything makes dramatic sense, where everything is densely packed and meaningful, you must do this. And I am the only one who writes outlines like this. So I am the only one who writes these massive historical books, merging the crime novel, the political novel, and the historical novel. That's why I'm Ellroy, and that's why I'm talking to you on this transcontinental telephone call.
James Ellroy. And yes, the next question I asked him in that interview was about his very healthy ego. Actually, that whole interview is such a treat. You can find it on the Book Show website if you haven't heard it yet. And today on the Book Show, I am bringing you some of the best pieces of writing advice that I've been given in my time as host of this show. It's a kind of writing masterclass from some of the biggest names in literature today. Okay, so you've got an idea, maybe you've mapped out a story plan. Now you need to decide where to work. It could be at a desk, on a couch, in a cafe, or maybe right in the middle of the house, like the poet Joy Harjo.
I'll work at the kitchen table. I often record at my kitchen table too, you know, or wherever. But my last job I had, they gave me money. It was the first time they'd given me money for office furniture. I didn't buy a desk. I bought a kitchen table.
And you put it in your office?
Yes, everybody loved it.
I love that idea of the messy kitchen table being the place where art is made. It's an idea that I think would appeal to the Booker-winning novelist Arundhati Roy, who told me she needs noise and chaos to help shape her work.
You know, I work all the time, when I'm walking, when I'm bathing, when I'm buying vegetables, I'm thinking all the time. But obviously, I live in Delhi, and so between Old Delhi, where I have a space, and New Delhi, which is where I actually live, I guess that's my writing space. But basically, my writing space is, I am a person who gets terrified when people ask me whether I want to retreat to a Swiss chalet and write my book. I might kill myself.
Why?
If I had to do that.
Why?
I don't know. I write in chaos.
So you don't want a too peaceful an environment to work in?
No, I mean, not a pristine, beautiful environment. I can't work in place like that. Somehow, I think I need to be in the world that my work is about, you know?
Arundhati Roy, and you'll hear more from her later. But now it's time to pick your writing tool. Most writers use a computer, but Michael Ondaatje, who you heard from earlier, he goes old school, choosing to write the first drafts of his manuscripts by hand.
I can type, but I'm not a very good typist and not very fast, and I can think faster than typing. So my handwriting is very, very bad, but at least it gets everything down. So when I'm writing, I usually, you know, have my Muji-lined notebooks, and I write draft after draft by hand. So about the first three or four drafts are done by hand. And that's about the right speed of thinking and writing for me.
And I've seen some images of your notebooks, as you've given a lot of your papers to the Harry Ransom Center in Texas. And these notebooks, Michael, you say your writing's not very neat, but the notebooks are really a thing of beauty. I was surprised by how visual they are, and that you might paste a clipping of a poem into the book, or a map, or an artwork. How does that help you in your process?
Well, some of the things, I mean, if there's a picture of a mural in Arezzo that I come across, I will sort of write the scene without double checking it, but then I will perhaps stick it in a space in the notebook. And so now it will look as if that they are very close to linked in the actual writing. But you know, sometimes it's like a little germ you're given to kind of put it into the notebook. And as the handwriting is so bad, I try to disguise it with a few visuals.
Just to make it more presentable.
Yes, I know.
You must be a nightmare for your publishers when they're trying to make sense of your notes.
Well, I do get the books typed out, you know, before I send it off, and then I have the type. Well, I have a type copy, and then at that point, I do rewrite it in a hard copy, then put it back on the computer. So there are many, many drafts. Some of them are the first three or four are all run by hand, and then the next 20 are typed versions. I go through a lot of editing in the process of writing a book.
And when do you know it's done? It's good to go.
Well, when they take it away from me, actually. I mean, I hang on to it as long as I can. And even in the final, what's called the ARC, the advanced reading copy, that is in fact quite different from the final version. I mean, there are lots of little changes I do. I'm a compulsive editor and keep not letting go and changing this and that.
Michael Ondaatje there. His latest novel is Warlight. And speaking of old school, Rodney Hall keeps it simple too, writing with a pencil and standing up while he does it.
Well, I've done it for about 40 years now. I'm fidgety. That's the problem, Claire. If I'm sitting down, I get twitchy and I think I'm trapped.
Rodney is a two-time Miles Franklin winner, and he invited me to his apartment in Melbourne to check out his very minimalist writing setup. I asked him why he chooses to write by hand. We do have a laptop computer sitting next to the book. When do you open the computer?
Oh, well, the computer's wonderful. I mean, I don't deny the computer. I have to write by hand because it comes out at the right speed and there's nothing between me and the meaning. Where the keyboard is still a sort of, although I'm quite fast, the keyboard is still a mechanism. And I can't hear my own rhythms because although it's a tiny sound, there is a kind of counter rhythm happening. And especially in words where you've got extra letters or syllables that we don't pronounce, like though and through and things, where you've got quite a lot of letters to go for a simple sound. And so typing gets in the way for me. It's initially faster, but it's not faster in that it has to all be revised. Where the handwriting, it's slow. And by the time the brain has written it, the brain's already on the next idea. But then I do all my own typing afterwards. So when I've got the handwritten book here, as you see, I only write on the right-hand page, double-spaced writings to allow me to have second thoughts. But if I have a stray idea, I put it on the left-hand page. And I know they're just random things I've thought of subsequent to writing. And, you know, trusty pencil, and we're off and away.
I got rhythm, I got music, I got my man, who could ask for anything more? I got daisies in green pastures, I got my man, who could ask for anything more?
You're listening to The Book Show with me, Claire Nichols, and today I'm sharing some of the top writing tips from some of the many fabulous authors who've appeared on the show over the last few years. And one thing lots of writers tell me about is the need to be diligent, to get to your desk or your kitchen table and work. And it's an approach that has certainly worked for the Australian-based crime writer Jane Harper. She wrote the first draft of her best-selling novel, The Dry, in just 12 weeks, all while working a full-time job.
I used to come home from work and I would stay in my work clothes and I would just sit down. I would almost like set the time and I would do 1 hour. And then at the end of 1 hour, I was like to stop, change out my work clothes, have dinner, watch TV. But I would do that hour. And because you only know you've got an hour, you kind of, you know, really try and make the most of it and power through, because otherwise you may as well, there's no point sitting and looking at a screen, you may as well just not bother. So little things like that really help, just trying to just do it in manageable chunks. And, you know, I think it was just like finding that discipline.
Jane Harper there, a writer with a pretty incredible work ethic. But that doesn't come so easily for all writers, of course. The British-Pakistani author Muhammad Hanif took 7 years to write his latest book, Red Birds. Now, I met him at Adelaide Writers' Week, and when I asked him why the book had taken so long, he gave a surprisingly refreshing answer.
Lazy, I guess. I'm lazy. I am generally kind of, you know, sort of slow. And as I said, I do quite a bit of journalism as well. But I am lazy. Sometimes writing is basically an excuse for me to kind of, you know, shut the door so that I don't have to do the house chores because, you know, I'm writing my novel. So I'm kind of just sitting there kind of staring at the blank screen or watching YouTube videos in the name of research or doing some the usual things that men usually do when you think that they're being productive. So I think that is my excuse for having taken so long to write it. I just met somebody who's written a fabulous novel, you know, at the festival, and I'd read it, and I was like, asked him, how long did it take you to write? And they said, 2 months. And I've been kind of, my God. Like, so basically you can write, you know, sort of. So yeah, next time I'm going to write my novel in 2 months, yeah.
Thanks to the very honest Muhammad Hanif. His latest book is Red Birds. So, you're in your workspace, you're hard at work on your novel. Do you play it safe with a straightforward narrative,
Or do you try something completely new? Now, Bernardine Evaristo is a risk taker. Her book, Girl, Woman, Other, has almost no full stops. There's lots of white space on the page, and the writing looks almost like poetry, with each thought given a new line. She calls her style fusion fiction, but says you can't force style. It has to serve the text.
For me, it is about the marriage between form and content. So it's not about imposing some kind of form on a story that I want to tell. It's about finding the form that tells the story in the best way possible. And that kind of emerges through the writing. What I find very interesting about this book is that it's selling so well, which is amazing. But also a lot of people aren't really referring to the form. Really? They're just engaging with the story. I mean, the critics refer to the form, but a lot of the responses I get are about the story. And I find that so interesting, because if you were to say to most people, this is an experiment, you know, let's say I hadn't won the Booker and you're presenting it to people, this is an experimental novel, there aren't many full stops, and the writing is a little bit poetic. Most people would say, oh, no, I don't read that kind of book. That's not what I'm interested in. But actually, because it's won the Booker and it's been given this massive endorsement, people are reading it and actually finding that they're reading past the form, in a sense, even though the book wouldn't exist without this form, because it's so enmeshed together. And so what you're describing as when the form is for its own sake or it's gratuitous isn't the case with this work. It's about how you approach it. So I teach creative writing, and when students say, oh, I want to experiment, I say to them, you have to find the experiment that is going to tell the story in the best way possible. Don't impose the experiment on artificially, because it will be exposed as something that's artificial.
Yeah, I didn't know I didn't need full stops in my life, but you've taught me that. So thank you.
Really bad for editing, though. Hard to edit it. It made me realise how the importance of the full stop, actually, when I came to editing, because it was just so free-flowing. I was like, oh my God, I couldn't even see it properly, because it was just too free, in a sense. So it took a long time to edit, about 2 years.
Bernardine Evaristo, whose risky writing has paid off, Girl, Woman, Other won the Booker Prize in 2019. Another experimentalist is the Irish writer Emma McBride, and all of her work is really distinctive, but her latest novel, Strange Hotel, wow, it really pushes the boundaries of form and style. And I asked her if that is a determined choice, if she is deliberately challenging herself to do something different to everyone else.
I think when I first started writing, that was very much on my mind. Now, contrariness seems to come naturally to me, whether I want to pursue it or not. I certainly thought when I was starting Strange Hotel that I was going to try and write something in very sort of conventional, straightforward language. But as the book progressed, I sort of realised that although I was using linear sentences and all the correct punctuation and grammatically it was all correct, that actually this character was using this conventional language as a way to create distance of between her and herself, really, of kind of pushing the world away. So she creates these very sort of long, convoluted sentences whereby she, in which she gets lost and can avoid the kind of the painful truths that she doesn't want to confront.
You make it sound almost like she's in control, Emma.
I think she's trying to be in control, and she certainly felt like she was in control when she was, you know, coming out of my head. You know, it was a character that I really felt I had to follow. And, you know, and I kept trying to make her kind of come out of the hotel room and come out of herself, but she didn't want to. She just, you know, she was just kind of interested in her own kind of convoluted journey.
You've often been described as a writer who almost writes stream of consciousness. A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing, your very well-received book, has also been described in that way. Is this writing something that really flows for you, Emma, in the process?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I mean, I think Girl is a Half-Formed Thing I wrote quite quickly, and Strange Hotel as well, but Lesser Bohemians took a very long time and was very kind of painfully constructed. But the aim of all the books in the end is that they do. I mean, certainly the first two books is that you should feel that that is something that's just coming straight out and not something that's been worked through. Strange Hotel is, you know, she's working very hard in it. So in a way, the reader is kind of forced to work hard as well.
I wanted to talk to you about that because I did have to work in this book. And I wondered if that's what you want me to do. I talked to Marcus Suzak last year, the Australian writer, and he was saying he wants readers to earn it. He wants readers to earn the read. Do you want your readers to do that?
It's not something that I set out to do, but I also don't think that there's any harm in asking readers to work hard. There are plenty of books that readers don't have to work hard, and I love those books as well. But, you know, sometimes it's okay to have to really concentrate, to not be able to just kind of skim through, to have to look at what the writer has written and know that they have written that for a reason, and that they want you to read every word and follow the logic through, no matter how uneasy it might make you feel or how much effort it makes you put in. And, you know, it's a very short book. It's, you know, it's not going to kill you. It's not like 1,000 pages of it.
Emma McBride there, and her very short book is called Strange Hotel. Now, whether you're getting experimental or not, at some point in the writing process, you are likely to get stuck. So what do you do then? John McPhee's advice is to keep the bear. John is a non-fiction writer, a Pulitzer Prize winner, and a teacher, and here he is explaining the advice he gave to a former student on how to tackle writer's block.
He was working for the Washington Post and writing a book, and he didn't know what he was doing, and he was complaining. And what I told him was to start a letter. If he was stuck, blocked, and everything, about some piece he knew what he was writing, but he couldn't get going on it, write, "Dear Mother. Dear Mother, I am trying to write about Alaska and about an encounter with a grizzly bear, and I'm going nowhere. I'm not cut out for this. I'm not a writer. I hate this. And this bear is driving me nuts. And this bear has a 55-inch waist, and he can outrun Secretariat," and so on. And then I said to Joel, "Go back and cut out the dear mother, and cut off all that whining and howling, and just keep the bear."
I don't hurt anymore.
I love that tip. Thanks to John McPhee.
No more walking the floor with that burning inside.
This is The Book Show. I'm Claire Nichols, and I'm wondering if writing gets easier as your career goes on. Let's ask Anne Patchett.
It does and it doesn't. But the way in which it does get easier is I know myself so well. I know that I'm never truly in a book until page 80. I don't know why that is. I know that on page 10, 15, 20, 38, 49, I always think the book is a disaster. But the nice thing about having done this so often is I can say to myself, "Oh, you're on page 49. You always feel like it's a disaster on page 49. You always want to throw it away and start a brand new book. Just stick it out till page 80 and then you'll feel better." So in that way, it's really easier because I live through these patterns over and over again. I've never written a whole book and thrown it out, but I also know that I always finish whatever I start. That's a great thing to know about yourself. Like, no matter what, I finish. If I'm writing a magazine piece and it's due the next day and I haven't figured it out, and I think, "Oh my gosh, I'm going to blow my deadline for the first time in my life." And I think, "You've never once blown a deadline, and chances are you're not going to blow a deadline now, and you're going to figure it out, because you always do, and I always do. So in that way, it's easier.
Anne Patchett. She's written 8 novels now, so she's had a bit of practice. Her latest book is The Dutch House. And like she says, in a way, it does get easier as it goes on. But I have wondered what it's like for award-winning authors like Anne to keep getting better every time. I wonder how much pressure do these big-name writers feel to make sure that this new book is better than the last one? Now, Colson Whitehead won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction for his novel The Underground Railroad, and I asked him if he felt stressed about living up to that success with his next book, The Nickel Boys.
You know, people ask, is it hard? You know, it's always hard. You know, this book is hard because you're depressed. This book is hard because you're broke. You have young kids. You've gone through a life change. I mean, the work never gets really easy if you're putting the real effort in. So I just did what I usually do, you know, trying to find a story that I find compelling and not screwed up page by page. And then obviously The Underground Railroad was a sort of once-in-a-lifetime success. And I've had books that have failed and books that have succeeded, you know, failed in different ways. And once you're done talking about it, you're done touring, it's just you and the page again. So I'm used to that, the challenge of a new book. And it's, you know, for me it was the same after book 8 as it was with book 1.
Colson Whitehead, who managed to keep calm and win a second Pulitzer Prize for The Nickel Boys. That's such a remarkable achievement. But I've got to say, not all writers I've spoken to are so relaxed about living up to their readers' expectations.
The unsung hero of this book is actually my wife, who made me quit writing it.
Wow.
Just so that I would know what it felt like, I think, to not finish it.
That's Marcus Zusak. You heard me mention him earlier when I was speaking to Emma McBride. Now, Marcus shot to worldwide fame with his novel The Book Thief, and then spent 13 years toiling on his next book, Bridge of Clay.
You know, The Book Thief meant everything to me, and I thought, I only want to write books now that mean everything to me. The books before that, they'd all really meant something to me. But when you write a book that means everything, you don't want to settle for less anymore.
So when it does mean everything to you, how much do you work and rework and rework to make it everything that you want it to be?
Well, there's not a word or sentence, or there's not a comma or a full stop in that in Bridge of Clay that I don't know or that isn't deliberate. And I think that's where I got to. I think there's a point with readers where you're looking after the reader all the time, and I love, you know, my readers, and you know, I think every writer, you know, feels like they've got the best readers in the world, you know, and I really feel that way. But there's a point where you have to say, right, what do I do? Do I try to make this easier for the reader? Do I try to make the, you know, I think you're always trying to cushion them, especially at the beginning. And there comes a point where you go, no, now I've got to write this for the people in the book. And especially in Bridge of Clay towards the end, I was trying to do right by Clay and his brothers and Penny, his mother, and Michael, his father, and even Carrie Novak, his best friend, and who's an apprentice jockey. And I was writing the book for them. You know, and I think that's when you really know that your aim is true, and then you're okay to cope with the consequences of whether people love you or not love you, or anything else in between.
Marcus Zusak, he got there in the end. Arundhati Roy also felt that need to push herself further when writing the follow-up to her Booker-winning novel, The God of Small Things. Her second novel, The Ministry of Utmost Happiness, was published 20 years after the first.
In a way, you have to write like a suicide bomber. You have to detonate yourself. You have to give everything, and then you have to reinvent yourself, you know? You can't kind of preserve yourself and put something in a bank account and live off the deposits or whatever, you know, off the interest. So I mean it as a way of saying that it's a risk. You have to throw yourself off a cliff. You have to give everything, and then you have to live again, and you have to layer it again, and then you make another universe. You have to find a new language for it too. You can't just keep recycling the old language, you know, however lyrical it may be. I just did a lecture yesterday where I said, you know, to write the Ministry of Utmost Happiness, I had to throw the language of the God of Small Things off a very tall building and then go down and pick up the pieces to make that mended heart in the graveyard.
Arundhati Roy, whose long-awaited second novel is The Ministry of Utmost Happiness. And you can hear in Marcus and Arundhati's comments there the real loyalty they feel to their readers. It's something that George Saunders spoke to me about too. Now, he is best known for his Booker-winning novel Lincoln in the Bardo, but he and I spoke about a lovely little book he wrote called Fox 8. Now, this is a fable, and it's narrated by a fox who has taught himself English. So the book is riddled with misspellings and strange turns of phrase, and I asked George how he got away with that.
The basic contract between a reader and her writer is, I think, it's one of mutual respect. So If you pick up my book, what I want to communicate to you is that I value your intelligence and your experience in the world and your good-heartedness, and now we're going to play a little game together. So I think little challenges like that can be fun, but from the writer's point of view, you have to really not phone it in. Mm-hmm. You know, I worked really hard on that book. It's a fun, I think, kind of silly book, but I worked so hard on it line to line, just as hard as I worked on the Lincoln book, because basically a writer, you know, lives or dies on the extent to which in each phrase he communicates his respect for the reader. And that takes, for me anyway, it takes a lot of repetition, a lot of time.
Do you have to know where the line is? Do you have to know how far you can push an audience? Because, you know, this book is from the first line of the book is Dear Reader, R-E-E-D-E-R. And from there, the misspellings and those challenges keep coming. Do you know where the line is, how far you can push us?
I think you're exactly right. That's sort of the ongoing job. With every line, I have to sort of say, where is Claire right now? Mm. You know, is she's probably getting a little annoyed with this spelling. Okay, let me make a joke that will make it worth her while and therefore bring her back into the fold. You know, this is the same problem with the Lincoln book, which it's got a kind of unusual form. And I mean, every day I went into the writing room thinking, okay, where is my ideal reader? Is she with me? Is she against me? You can sometimes have a reader too much with you. You can be not challenging the person or not almost, you know, sort of making it so easy that it would feel like you're not aware that she's on the other end of the conversation. So I would say that in a nutshell is the whole writing game, is to know where the line is and where you are with respect to it. And also, I think sometimes to understand that, you know, it's kind of like I haven't dated in like 500 years, but from what I remember of dating, you might, on a date, start to lose somebody. You know, you might start to be boring, or you might start to be too obtuse. That doesn't actually mean the date is over. But as long as you acknowledge where you are, you can bring the person back into your orbit. So I think likewise with writing, if for example, like the beginning of the Lincoln book is difficult, I think, part of your job is to know that your reader is getting a little fed up. Then if at some point you redeem yourself, you get kind of a double helping of redemption, because they were doubting you and you brought them back. So I think the whole thing is really a very intimate conversation with another person. And I think the difference between good writing and not so good writing is, in good writing, the writer really elevates you, the reader. I think very highly of you. In writing that's not so successful, you can feel that the writer has put the reader beneath her and is condescending or preaching or lecturing or recycling jokes and so on, and I think that's what makes for a bad relationship.
Night and day, you are the one.
George Saunders, another Booker winner, with some more really great writing tips there. Remember that one, check in on your reader. And funnily enough, that's not the last time you'll hear an author equating writing with dating in this special episode of The Book Show, where I've pulled together some of the very best writing tips from the very best writers that have appeared on the show over the last few years.
Day and night, why is it so?
Let's turn now to Ben Okri. He's a Nigerian author and a poet, and yes, another Booker winner. And like George Saunders, he is always thinking of readers when he writes.
I write for people who read for a secret reason. You know, there are two kinds of readers. The people who read to distract themselves. You know, they read because they want to pass the time. I write for them too, but I really write for people who are reading for a secret reason. They go to books because there's something, they have this sense that somewhere out there or inside us, there's a trail, there's something that can point us, guide us towards something. And I write for those secret readers because that's what I am. I read for the same reason. I'm not very good at reading for distraction. If I want to distract myself, there's plenty of other things to do. You know, there's television. Television is much better at distraction. Yeah. There's film, there's just looking at people. Mm. Just go to a big city, sit in a square and just watch people. That's great distraction. I don't really read for distraction. I read because I read for that hunger. I read to save my life. I read to keep alive.
The beautifully poetic Ben Okri there. And as we come to the end of today's writing masterclass, let's talk a bit about the end of a novel. Once it's written and hopefully published, how do you say goodbye and move on to the next one? Well, let's finish where we started with Tayari Jones.
When I finish one novel, I'm so lonely for a project that it's almost like a relationship. I just jump headlong into another project and I'm in a relationship with a new project for a few months, and then I realize that, oh, that was just a rebound, and then I break up with that project. So I've done that, and now I'm waiting for the real book to, you know, ask me out.
And I wonder, where are you haunting to find the inspiration? Any more food courts? Are you trying somewhere new to find that bolt of inspiration?
Well, you know, I have, you know, swung through a few food courts, but I didn't find anyone there with, I just know it'll happen. I think that finding a subject for a novel is a little bit like finding love. You know, you do have to leave the house to find love generally, but there's not a lot you can do to make love come to you. You just have to be open to it. And I feel like that, like I'm just open to an idea, and you know, I've got a ribbon in my hair, and I hope I'll catch its eye.
This will be an everlasting love. This will be the one I've waited for. This will be the first time anyone.
Thanks to Tayari Jones and to all the fabulous writers who've shared their pearls of wisdom on The Book Show today. I'm Claire Nichols, and what are you waiting for? Go and get writing. Talk soon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.